So I am here with Danielle Thompson, who is most recently the co-writer and director of Change Your Plans. Danielle, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
I wanted to first of all start off about confinement and physical space. In Jet Lag, you have two characters who are predominantly occupying a hotel room. In Avenue Montaigne, you have a broader physical space with the cultural world. And in this, you have, of course, the dinner party in 11 characters. It's the ultimate locked room mystery of life. So my question to you is whether you pursue this confinement as a way to generate dramatic conflict, or whether this reflects more a concern upon the home truths that come out with this human relationship with physical space.
Well, we're dealing with of course, the question of time and space.
Yes.
In all fiction. It's true that it's a challenge to have 11 people in the same place one night, and then again one night a year after.
Yeah.
Not in the same place. I mean, this is. I don't want to give out all the.
Sure.
All the.
But we're talking predominantly the first dinner party.
Right.
Yeah.
It seemed that it was the ideal frame for the original idea for the film. The original idea for the film, my original ideas are usually very tiny. They're like a little seed, you know, and then we have to work on it for weeks and sometimes months to find out whether that seed is going to, you know, give out some kind of flower or tree or whatever.
Or transform, in this case, to a Baroque redwood.
Exactly. So the original idea was I was fascinated by the fact that when we meet friends in the evening, our friends and ourselves are not the same people in the afternoon or the day or whatever, because I thought, you know, we all have few choices in life. You know, waking up in the morning and going to work is not a choice. It's an obligation.
Yeah.
7 o'clock, 6 o'clock, 8 o'clock in France, it's a little later than in America. You can make a decision of not going out to dinner.
Yeah.
You have that choice. You can call and say, I'm sick, I have a headache, I have a problem. So if you do go out, you know, the politeness, it's the least thing you can do is bring something of yourself, the more sunny side of yourself.
Yeah.
And that's what people do, and therefore people lie.
Yeah.
People pretend.
Yeah.
And the lovely thing about it, and this is why it's kind of an apology, it's kind of a you know, an aspect of lie that I think is very important in social life. You believe in it yourself. It makes you feel better. It makes you feel, you know, you have a sort of an entr'acte, you know, an intermission in your own life where you have laughed and told funny jokes and pretended that everything goes going well with your couple and with your children or your work. And I thought it was a very funny idea to make the audience aware of what these people's life were really during the afternoon and then see what happens at night.
But I would also argue with you that their audience is also aware of the physical space, particularly since you have the actors often sitting down. I mean, normally when we see a dinner party at a film, they're all walking around. There is some of that, but most of the conversation takes place when they're seated, and I found that a very interesting choice on your part. So that's why I have to ask you about this confinement and physical space.
Well, the confinement and physical space actually was the thing that was first, very interesting to do, and second, I was very aware of the trap it could become and how static suddenly the film could be, and this is why very quickly in the writing of the screenplay, we decided that, Christopher and I, that we wanted to blow up, to break this space, to, you know, and this, and suddenly go forward to the next year.
Sure.
And then go back to the dinner, and then go forward to the next year. Because, you know, it's also something that's magical. I mean, that you can go to flashbacks and show what happened before, because you know what happened before, but you very rarely know what's going to happen after. And so this was something we did, in fact, because that confinement was scary. And but you know, so in fact, I wanted to play both sides of it.
Got it. Well, this also leads me to ask you, seeing as how you write these scripts with your son, you're dealing now with the second ensemble piece with many characters. So you have a situation in which, you know, every writer to some degree is going to put an aspect of themselves in each character, but the more you spread yourself out, the more of a risk you have in, I suppose, finding similarities among characters. What do you do to defeat that? What did you do to defeat that? Was it possibly the concern for vocation that is often in your films? I mean, these characters, your characters tend to announce what they do for a living very early, I must say.
Well, it defines very, very much also why they're there together.
Yeah.
Some people are very old friends, know each other very well, and therefore, you know, have this kind of cruelty that sometimes friendship generates, which is that, you know, they speak very much about people's problems, and they know what's wrong with them and what they don't like in them, and therefore but they like them, because, you know, when you like your friends, you it's because also you know who they really are. Some other people, of course, this goes back to the problem of choice and why you decide to go out at night. Some people have an interest. I mean, some people, you know, there's a professional reason for some people. Somebody else is in love and wants to see her again, hoping that things will get better. And so, you have to also this aspect of having a slight social difference between people. I mean, there's a guy who makes kitchens. There's a woman who is a teacher of flamenco who actually should not really be invited, but was invited because they missed a woman at the last moment. You have the host, who's actually unemployed and goes through the problems of having a very successful wife as a lawyer and him being in a very weak position in the couple and so
having
on.
Having loads of spare time to do other things.
Yes, exactly. And so this is very much part of our lives. I mean, the mixture of what we do and who we are and how we deal with, you know, these things, and especially in a group of people who mostly are in their 40s.
Yeah.
Which is, to me, you know, very much a moment of truth. Moment of whether you sometimes have had a long relationship, a long already, you know, you can be 40 and having have a marriage, a 15-year-old or 20-year-old marriage, and this is a difficult time because it wears out, and it's you know, you're still very attractive, you can still change your life completely and go on to other things. It's not too late.
Yeah.
It's not too late to change everything. So in that film, some people do, some people don't.
On the other hand, I will say that these characters offer a rather pat justification for this dilemma in their lives, not just in this film, but also in Avenue Montaigne. There's a line, some people are a bridge between two lives in this film, and in Avenue Montaigne, there's that explanation that one character gives between being in one stage of life when you're building a home, and the next stage is buying a home. This seems to me a little too pat, a little too much of a binary opposition, and I'm curious if this goes along with this theme of lying and trying to find an explanation that really doesn't exist, that life is really just about dancing, or inviting dance, or inviting randomness, or inviting tapas into your life.
Well, it's not. It's not really about life being dancing. I mean, I think it's hard to compare because Avenue Montaigne is a kind of a fairy tale.
Yeah,
and it has a happy ending, and it's a very different kind of story. Change of plans is much more realistic, I think, and. You know, it's not something. I mean, it is true that sometimes, you know, you meet people who are and who are used and sometimes sacrificed for the rhythm of your own life, which is that you need someone to be brave enough to leave your past life, but it's not always the person who will be hand in hand with you for the rest of your life. And this is a very cruel thing for the person who falls into this pattern. But it exists, and this is not what the film is about. This basically what the film is about is several things in a way, and I think this is not a very politically correct thing to say, especially in America.
The
virtues of lying, and I'm not, you know, being a French frivolous person to say this and to deal with it as comedy, because lie is, you know, is something that we need to live with, and and there's also this attitude sometimes that I hear in when Americans speak to us about, you know, our French civilization and the fact that, you know, we don't consider adultery as important as you do, or lying as important as you do. I think we do. I think the pain is the same. I think there is a form of tolerance.
And
this is very much what the film's about. It's you know, how much you can pretend that, you know, which allows you to go on.
Sure.
I'm not sure if I'm being very clear.
No. This does actually bring up one aspect I wanted to ask you. You mentioned Avenue Montaigne is a more fantasy approach to an ensemble piece. This leads me to wonder, though, if you extracted certain truths that you experienced. This kind of goes back to my other question about you and your son extracting selves into characters. But I was always very curious if the pianist stripping off his clothes before the audience was related on any particular real incident, or whether any, you know, how much of this could be drawn from anecdotes or little episodes in life that you experienced, or are you more committed to the idea of the lie to tell the truth from a filmmaking standpoint?
Well, to go back for a second to Avenue Montaigne, this was very much, it was very much also a story about the place you have in life, and especially the place where people actually lock you in.
Yeah.
And it's true about the actress who dreams to become Sidney Pollack's Simone de Beauvoir. But you know, she's on a sort of a stupid TV show, and people will not admit that she has talent enough to, you know, because people are locking you into these roles that, in every sense of the word. And the pianist is also actually was something that I thought of, because I have a very close friend who actually was the advisor on the film as far as music was concerned, who, you know, are locked into a system ever since they're sometimes children, you know, being very, very talented young people who play the piano, and suddenly they have no childhood anymore, and they have no adolescence anymore, and they go into life with a lot of success, with a lot of trips, with a lot of people applauding, and but it also becomes a jail. And this friend of mine who actually he's a very famous pianist. One day, took a piano, an old piano, but took a piano as a symbol, hung it on a helicopter, and dropped it in a lake, and had the press there, and therefore, you know, sort of it was like a declaration of war to the system, and said, from now on, I'm not going to be part of this anymore. I'm going to do other things, other ways. And this is not done in classical music, ever. Yeah. I mean, this was an enormous thing. So I thought of this because, of course, I didn't want to go into a lake with a piano with this film. It was not. But I thought it was an interesting symbol, this outfit that actually is another form of the jail, you know, having to have this tie, this whatever you call it, tailcoat, and, you know, and being locked in there. And it was a symbol that I thought was nice, you know, to show on the images. So this was very much part of the theme of that film. Now, the other the part about change of plans is very much something that has to do with dealing with the change in your life, the change in your life, but not that way. The change in your everyday life, not in an art, not in this very, very spectacular theater, or for an actress, or for a guy who plays the piano, or for a very, very rich man who sells his collection of paintings, but for people like you and I,
yeah,
who go through these questions as everybody's choice always leads you to some kind of jail. And you know, in your couple, in your work, and so are you going to shake it? And suddenly, it's very hard. And it's, you know, and when you're 40 again, as most of these people are around their 40s, sometimes it's a wonderful thing to break up a marriage. It's not always a failure. Sometimes, and I think one of the couples who are going to decide to leave each other, they're right.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. They're probably both going to be better off. Others won't. Others are going to stick to it, and we don't give the answers. We don't have the answers. This is the end of the film. Who knows what's going to happen?
On the other hand, Melanie, speaking from, you know, directly to the creator, is a bit punished for her, you know, willingness to.
I don't see it that way. Huh. I think
unless, of course, she's just bearing the cross.
She's probably happier the way she is, because, in fact, she was going to make a big mistake. She was going to break up, in fact, a wonderful relationship. And in a way, you can call it a punishment, but it's all. She doesn't look unhappy when after this punishment comes.
Yeah.
She actually looks more beautiful. You know, this was something we discussed with my. With my actress and with my costume people and everything. I said I would like her in the second part of the film, when she's supposed to have been punished. Well, she looks better. She's more sexy. She looks happier. She's resolved. She's realized that he's the man. And, you know, and she was going to blow up a wonderful marriage for some kind of crazy jockey.
Yeah.
So.
Well, going back to your thoughts on jails, I should also point out that the pianist in Avenue Montaigne, he has this desire, like, I want to play in hospitals, I want to play around the sick, that somehow shifting the space will escape his life. And similarly in this, we were talking about the fact that there are two dinners in, you know, in two different locations, essentially. It's almost as if the idea here is that these characters can shift their physical space with which to escape the inevitability of life. I'm curious why this has been a preoccupying concern of jail. Maybe physical space or shifting a location is kind of a way that these characters lie.
Well, we didn't think of it this way. I think basically it's more a question actually of time than space.
Yeah.
It's interesting also to project yourself in the future year, not in these flashbacks. You know, so often in movies you show, in fact, what people do, and then you have an explanation because years and years ago, or years, you know, a month and months ago, such and such thing happened, and this is why they behave this way. Now, what we did was the opposite. We made them arrive at the dinner and behave this way, having shown before and having had the audience as our friends, you know, showing them who these people really are, and then they sit down, and then suddenly, actually, we do something which I wish we could all do in life, which is show what's going to happen the following year, and how so many things change in a year, that suddenly this woman who the following year is also this 21st of June where everybody plays music in the streets of Paris and everywhere in France, which is now something that very much part of our culture. Well, to get the same people together a year later, no way. No way. For so many different reasons. Some wonderful reasons. Some people have had wonderful things happen to them. Others have had terrible things happen to them, you know. And this is true. If we look back on the previous year, my God, and our friends, the ones who got married, the ones who died, the ones who are sick, the ones who have children, the ones who quit their jobs. I mean, a year is such a short time, and yet so full of, you know. So this was very much to do with time. Yeah. And time, as again, I sometimes, you know, speak about this a lot in my films, I guess. Time passes so quickly, my God, you know. And the more this is why I was, so it was also interesting to get in two older people in the story who have a different philosophy on life than the ones who are 40.
I also wanted to ask you, there's a quote by Lao Tzu, you can see the world without getting outside. I know I'm still stuck on space, but I actually wanted to ask you how you avoid cinematic depictions of Paris with this sentiment in mind. I mean, that allow for this romantic feel, this almost Lubitsch-like feel that's often in your films. Does shooting within interiors to a certain point allow you to avoid this problem? Did the street music night present the sort of the smoking gun to avoid the inevitable kind of touristy depiction of Paris?
Well, I'm not sure I quite understood your question.
Oh, well, I mean, essentially just to clarify, I mean, you have a very romantic depiction of Paris that doesn't often seem touristy. And yet, I'm trying to conflate this with the Lao Tzu quote about you can see the world outside without stepping outside. And so I'm curious about what steps you have taken to, number one, why there's such a focus on interiors often in your films, and second, what you do when you are out and shooting exteriors, how you manage to just avoid the kind of the obvious choices.
Well, you know, I'm a Parisian myself,
yeah.
So I find Paris day and after day more beautiful than ever, and you know, it's hard to resist a shot of the Eiffel Tower when it lights up, you know, during the summer.
Sure.
In this particular film, I thought, as of course it is during an evening and then the same evening a year later, I thought, well, is this going to be a night film? Is it going to be all in, you know, am I going to be shooting in the night and everybody's driving at night during the dinner and so on? So I thought, well, the longest day is the 21st of June, because it's daylight in Paris until about 10:30 in the evening. Then the 21st of June, my God, this is the day of La Fête de la Musique, you know, the music day. So it's now become a huge event in France. It's all over. And in fact, Jacques Lang, who invented it, our ex-minister of culture, is now flying to Shanghai because they're doing it in China now. You can imagine it took it in a lot of countries.
I'd like to see one here.
Yes, it's wonderful, yeah. Because it actually goes from huge concerts with big stars, you know, in stadiums with 100,000 people, or just your little group, three people in the corner of a street, and people dancing in the streets, like on the 14th of July. Or, you know, it's an amazing atmosphere. So this actually brought suddenly something to the atmosphere of the movie, which I thought was irresistible. I thought, this is it, you know. And in fact, a lot of people organize a dinner that night, whether it's in a little bistro because you're going to have music, or your house and you can come out and have a drink outside and you know, the musicians at every corner of the streets. So it's a very special day. And so it does actually help that confinement because of the sound, because of the light, because you can actually have all this action during the evening, which has the daylight, which to me was like breathing a special, something, the light actually being completely the opposite of being locked in. So it was very much more a question of light than tourism. If this is, you know,
more of a communal scenario,
yes,
that these characters really don't want to partake in, because they're behind this bunker with a door that has a constantly changing access code. That to me is a true jail. They don't even bother to really step out, and you know, when they do step out, they're not nowhere near all this excitement. It's almost as if they don't want to partake in this communal wonder.
Well, it's, you know, the name of the film in French is Le Code a changé, which is the code has changed. And funnily enough, also, this is something totally now in the French language, which is that, you know, you can never go anywhere, whether it's for dinner or an appointment or anything, without having the code written on your telephone or whatever, or written, because every single door in France has a code now.
Yeah.
So this is why, in fact, we found a new title for the American version of the film, because but we live with this. Thank God we have cell phones and we can call, yeah. Because actually, 9 times out of 10, the code has changed, because that's the point. The point is that you want to be protected, so you change the code so people can't go into your building. So, you know, and so I thought this was a wonderful metaphor, of course, because, yeah. You know, the code now, somebody said to me, are you going to call it Le Code a changé? What about the Da Vinci Code? I thought, oh my God, I never thought of that.
Yeah, that's our traveling code here. Well, I mean, speaking of the Da Vinci Code, I mean, how does a movie, you indicated in a Charlie Rose interview, you said, one of my biggest fears is boring people. Now, here you have a very abundant cast in this film. Is this a way of, competing with Hollywood spectacle by populating your films with numerous characters who are, even the conflict between the oncologist and the gynecologist, one who specializes in death and one who specializes in birth. I mean, that conflicts along these lines and very elaborate characters are the way to sort of, I guess, beat Hollywood for their vapid spectacle? Or
most of these actors, half of these actors are big stars in France.
Yes.
You don't know them in America, so in fact...
Well, Danny Boone, so...
Well, Danny Boone, yeah, but, you know, he actually was not a big star when I hired him. He became a big star in the middle of... just afterwards. But French people have this, as you know, this big movie industry. They love their actors. And... in all my films, since the beginning, I've always was attracted with the idea of having a cast that is surprising to the French audience, even though they know these people very well. Because, you know, we have... a lot of directors like to work with families of actors. And in a lot of their films, you find the same actors all over again. I work the other way. I love when I look at a poster, I think, oh my God, what is he doing with her? Or you know. So I mixed, as I was saying, very famous actors and some totally unknown, like the Spanish girl who's a dancer and the guy who plays the guy who makes the kitchen, who is a wonderful actor from the Comédie Française. But yes. These people are always more anonymous because they're part of a troupe of some of them, like the one who plays the father of ML, you know, who Pierre Arditi, who's been in a lot of Alain René's films, and he's a wonderful theater actor, and he's been in a million movies, and people love him, and yet he's not a star in the way that Patrick Bruel, who plays the oncologist, is a huge star, is a rock singer. So you have these people who are very different one from another, and it's a big attraction for me, first for me, because they're good actors too, otherwise I wouldn't use them, and for the people. And in fact, it's going to be very refreshing. I'm going to watch the movie tonight here in New York, to hear the people's reactions, because for you, the American audience, they're just actors. There's nothing attached.
Oh, well, wait a minute.
There's not a big career attached to them, and there's no references, or very few, or maybe for you because you're an expert, but for the American audience in general, they might have seen so-and-so in some French film 2 years ago, but I don't remember exactly which one. But for us, they're very identified. And so this is also why I wanted to mix the very famous ones with the very unknown ones. So you'd get this surprising mixture.
You're saying that a character can't live unless there's some sort of fame attachment or some celebrity aspect?
Of course, thank God they can live.
I mean, I just defend American audiences.
The answer will be here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see, it's a very interesting aspect of it, because it is true that it attracts, my God, the Americans know this better than anybody else in the world. It's true that actors attract people who love them. Yeah. So, but of course, you know, suddenly if you have, we were talking about the Da Vinci Code, if it's not Tom Hanks...
Yeah.
I don't know. It could be somebody else, but it's Tom Hanks, and that's a good idea.
Well, Tom Hanks seems a really sad way to end this conversation, but Danielle, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat.